Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres touched down in Poland on Tuesday, bound for Ukraine. The UN chief's spokesperson said that Mr. Guterres would meet President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv on Wednesday. They are expected to discuss the continuation of the successful Black Sea Grain Initiative set up by the UN to ensure that Ukrainian grain exports and Russian food and fertilizer can reach global markets and stave off famine around the world. Malawi's deadly cholera outbreak could worsen if, as expected, tropical cyclone Freddy triggers further heavy rainfall in the south of the country, the UN said on Tuesday. From the UN Children's Fund UNICEF, Malawi representative Rudolf Schwenk said that since the outbreak was officially announced a year ago, cholera has spread to 29 districts across Malawi.
All over the country, affecting more than 50,000 people with over 1,500 deaths. And of these, more than 12,000 children have contracted cholera, and unfortunately 197, almost 200, have died.
Ongoing COVID-19 cases across the nation, along with an earlier outbreak of cholera in Malawi, have drained resources and left health services overwhelmed, UNICEF said. In a related warning, the UN World Meteorological Organization, WMO, said that tropical cyclone Freddy will once again bring more heavy rainfall to the south of the country, according to Malawi's National Weather Service. The development will likely create additional life-threatening challenges to communities already struggling as the rainy season reaches its height, combined with the fact that it is now the annual lean season in Malawi. The UN and partners on Tuesday issued an urgent appeal for $876 million to help Rohingya refugees and their hosts in Bangladesh. The funding is needed to support 1.47 million people and involves 116 partners, nearly half of them national organizations from Bangladesh. Almost a million Rohingya refugees who fled Myanmar and are now sheltering in Bangladesh will get help, along with nearly half a million Bangladeshis in neighboring communities. They'll receive food, shelter, healthcare, access to drinkable water, protection services, education, as well as livelihood opportunities and training. Women and children make up more than 75% of the targeted refugee population. They face higher risks of abuse, exploitation and gender-based violence, warned the UN Refugee Agency, which noted that more than half of the refugees in camps are under 18. A huge fire on Sunday tore through part of vast Cox's Bazar camp in Bangladesh, leaving thousands without shelter. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. The Missouri Radio Free Kansas.
Good afternoon, listeners. Good afternoon. Yes, we're live and the green room is open. Now, we may not have any time. We may not have any time to put you on the air, but the green room is open if you'd like to visit. We have a full schedule today. It's weather on Wednesday. And coming up in the second hour,
feminist theologian Rifat Hassan on Adam and Eve.
In Arabic, every word is either masculine or feminine. So it says, and God created all of you from one single nafs, nafs being feminine. And then it goes on to say, and God created, minha means from her, her going back to nafs, which is feminine, zaujha, her mate.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's right, that'll be in the second hour. And as we open up every weekday show with the latest from the United Nations Radio, here is the morning headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The occupied West Bank's observing a general strike today, one day after Israeli forces raided a Jenin refugee camp, killing six Palestinians and injuring 26 others. It was the latest deadly attack by Israel, which has killed at least 73 Palestinians since the start of the year. Meanwhile, in the Palestinian village of Houada, Israeli settlers ambushed a family, including an elderly man and a toddler. This is the family's grandmother describing the attack.
We were done with shopping and got into the car. He was about to switch the car on. Suddenly, we did not know where they come from. They were like rabid dogs, attacking all at once. We did not see them. The road was empty. It seems like they wait and lay low and hunt people down.
In Ukraine, the mercenary Wagner Group says it's captured eastern Bakhmut, the site of protracted deadly fighting. Ukraine has vowed to keep defending the city, saying it's repelled significant attacks and warning its loss would lead to an open road through Ukraine's east for Russian forces. Meanwhile, Kyiv has denied any involvement in September's attack on the Nord Stream pipelines after the New York Times reported unnamed U.S. intelligence officials suggesting a pro-Ukrainian group was responsible, but that there is no evidence the group was directed by Ukrainian officials. Meanwhile, in Russia, student blogger Dmitry Ivanov has been sentenced to over 8 years in prison for being critical of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ivanov addressed reporters from the courtroom.
You must understand that Russia is not Putin. We didn't vote for him, and he didn't ask us about starting this war with our close neighbors. I know that tens of millions of people here in Russia are against this criminal war. A lot of, of us have friends and relatives in Ukraine, and we feel their pain.
In the country of Georgia, police use water cannons and tear gas against protesters in the capital, Tbilisi, as thousands of people turned out to condemn a proposed law on so-called foreign agents. The contested bill would require non-governmental organizations and independent media outlets that receive more than 20% of their funding from international sources to declare themselves agents of foreign influence. Critics slam the move as a violation of press freedom and civil society. Georgians also fear it would jeopardize the country's bid for European Union membership. Georgian President Salome Zurabishvili vowed to veto the bill, though the ruling party has enough votes to override that.
No one needed this law. It came from nowhere, but maybe it was dictated from Moscow. It needs to go. It needs to be repealed any way you want.
In Egypt, three journalists from the independent news website Matamaser are on trial, facing up to 2 years in prison and $10,000 fines for allegedly misusing social media and offending members of parliament. Rana Mamdouth, Sara Saif Aden, and Bisan Kassab are being tried over an article last year about a government watchdog that uncovered gross financial misconduct among politicians. It's the latest attack on Matamaser by the government of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who Amnesty International is accused of turning journalism into a crime. Reporters Without Borders says 73 women journalists around the world are spending International Women's Day behind bars. Spain's government approved a draft law aimed at bolstering equal representation of women in politics, business, and other institutions. The measure, announced by Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez at a rally for the Socialist Party over the weekend, will now be debated and voted on by the Spanish Parliament. This is Spain's economy minister, Nadia Calviño.
It establishes a target of 40% female participation in public and private management and decision-making bodies with a realistic timetable. On the political level, electoral candidacies must have an equal composition of men and women by alternate lists. And finally, it is stipulated that the Spanish government must also be governed by the principle of a balanced presence of women and men.
The number of pregnant and breastfeeding women and girls experiencing malnutrition has skyrocketed since 2020 over 12 countries in Africa and Asia. That's according to UNICEF, which says nearly 7 million mothers are suffering from hunger as a food shortage crisis has worsened due to the war in Ukraine, the climate crisis, ongoing conflict, and the pandemic. The hardest hit nations include Afghanistan, Yemen, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan. Children born to malnourished mothers are more likely to develop chronic health issues and have a higher risk of mortality. Back in the United States, five women are suing Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risks to their health and were non-viable. The Center for Reproductive Rights is bringing the lawsuit on behalf of the women and two doctors. This is plaintiff Amanda Zarosky.
I cannot adequately put into words the trauma and despair that comes with waiting to either lose your own life, your child's life, or both. For days, I was locked in this bizarre and avoidable hell. In a matter of minutes, I went from being physically healthy to developing sepsis, a condition in which bacteria in the blood develops into infection with the ability to kill in under an hour.
It's the first such lawsuit since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year, triggering a rash of abortion bans in states across the United States. Gigi Sohn, President Biden's pick for the Federal Communications Commission and a champion of net neutrality and consumer rights, has withdrawn her nomination following an onslaught of attacks by industry lobbyists. On Tuesday, conservative Democrat Joe Manchin confirmed he would not vote to confirm Sohn. Companies like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast killed her nomination over Sohn's support of net neutrality and low-cost broadband. Right-wing outlets also launched a homophobic smear campaign against her. She is a lesbian. She said in a statement, quote, "It is a sad day for our country and our democracy when dominant industries with assistance from unlimited dark money get to choose their regulators. And with the help of their friends in the Senate, the powerful cable and media companies have done just that," she said. The FCC, which should have five commissioners, has been at a partisan 2-2 deadlock since December 2020. The Justice Department is sued to block JetBlue's $3.8 billion acquisition of Spirit Airlines. It's the first time in over two decades the U.S. government has intervened to block an airline merger and the latest antitrust action from the Biden administration. This is Vinita Gupta, Associate Attorney General.
Ultra-low-cost carriers like Spirit play a key role in the economy. They make air travel possible so more Americans can take a hard-earned family vacation or celebrate and mourn together with loved ones. We allege that the proposed merger would lead to fewer seats and higher prices for travelers. And we allege that the proposed merger would heighten the risk that remaining airlines would coordinate to raise prices.
And in France, 1.3 million people took to the streets Tuesday in the sixth and largest yet nationwide protest against raising the pension age from 62 to 64. Train services were disrupted, schools shut, fuel deliveries blocked. Police used water cannons and tear gas against some of the crowds. Union leaders say they'll continue disrupting public life until the government acquiesces to the widespread public opposition to its plan. This is a retired worker speaking at a march in Paris.
It is about our children, our grandchildren. I mean, imagine how it will be in 50 years if we reduce the few rights that employees have for the benefit of the corporations that earn intolerable profits without being taxed, of course.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Happy International Women's Day, Nermeen.
Happy International Women's Day to you too and to our audiences. Welcome across the country and around the world.
Yes, it is International Women's Day.
Hi, I'm Jack R. Johnson, and this is Hidden Histories. You stand on a street corner and wait. You've been told to wear something conspicuous, an agreed-upon item of clothing, a red scarf, a black beret. 10-15 minutes pass by in a part of town you normally avoid. A Plymouth slows to a stop. A voice from inside tells you to get in. You're blindfolded, driven through a confusing maze of twists and turns until finally your destination is reached. In darkness, you climb a flight of stairs, hardly daring to talk until you are led into the room where the abortion is to be performed. It's like something out of a crime thriller, only it actually happened, frequently in fact. Sometimes by doctors, other times by novices, and sometimes by ladies in training who belong to a collective dedicated to getting women decent reproductive care in Chicago from 1969 to 1973. They were known simply as Jane, or the Jane Service, because the women who answered the phones always used the pseudonym Jane. More formally, their title was the Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation. The collective originated with the University of Chicago student Heather Booth, who helped her friend's sister find an abortion provider. They found a physician they called Mike, who was willing to work with them, but they soon discovered that Mike, unfortunately, wasn't actually a physician. The techniques he used, however, were safe, and they were effective. So the women behind Jane's service decided to cut out the middleman, and they decided to perform the abortions themselves. According to Pauline Bart, during the years when the Jane service operated, that Chicago collective performed more than 12,000 safe abortions. The collective ended in 1973 when Roe v. Wade finally legalized abortions nationwide. This is Jack R. Johnson for Hidden Histories.
So no matter how much history drags us back, or should I say the controlling forces, which after all is not the working class, drags us back, we're going to go forward. And there are ways we can go forward again. Now, coming from border British Columbia in Canada, Alex Smith and the world's largest archive of environmental radio shows. This show is broadcast on over 105 radio stations. It's called Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The latest and best overview of climate feedback is out. UK scientist Tim Lenton reports possible futures. From New York, author and activist Andrew Boyd on his new book, I Want a Better Catastrophe. Radio EcoShock starts right now.
China and India are increasing coal burning. Oil and gas companies never made so much money. We know what is going to happen, except we don't. Even with stunning climate science, global models, and the summary reports, we could be flying blind into unexpected catastrophes. A group of leading scientists say many risky feedback loops amplify the need for climate action. They have a list of 60 forces, physical, biologic, and human, all bouncing into our times, feeding back into a destabilized climate. Here to explain is one of our favorite British scientists, Professor Tim Lenton, Director of Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. Tim is a co-author of the new paper, along with Bill Ripple from Oregon, and two of my heroes, Johan Rockström of the Stockholm Resilience Center, and Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, Founding Director of the Potsdam Institute. These are senior climate scientists, and they are worried. From the UK, Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Is it true, Tim? Are you and your co-authors worried about the known unknowns of climate change?
I'm afraid we are. Yes, we're in this particular study, we're just cataloguing and highlighting the feedback loops that can amplify climate change, and noting that we still need to do better at studying and quantifying those, because they can act together to make that climate change considerably worse.
Could you remind our listeners of what a climate feedback loop is and maybe give us an example?
Yeah, so a climate feedback loop is when an initial change in the climate, like some amount of warming, triggers a response from within the climate system that either adds to the warming or counteracts it. If it adds to the warming, we call it a reinforcing or amplifying feedback loop. If it counteracts the warming, we would call it a damping feedback loop or a balancing feedback loop. And we have to worry about how strong, in particular, the amplifying feedback loops. So how much of an extra change you get from the feedback. And there are several of those amplifying feedback loops, and an example would be one we refer to as the ice albedo feedback, which is a fancy scientific way of talking about how if you replace a highly reflective surface of ice, like sea ice on the ocean in the Arctic, with a darker ocean surface, if you melt the ice away, then that darker ocean surface absorbs way more sunlight, over the sunlight basically that the ice would have been reflecting. That heats things up further and tends to melt more sea ice, which exposes even more dark ocean surface, which absorbs more heat, and now it's more sea ice and so on. And that was a pretty strong reinforcing feedback.
You and your co-authors have been studying feedbacks and tipping points for years. Why bring out this new big list?
It felt like we ought to look again and update the list of feedback loops, because the last time it had really been thoroughly catalogued that I can remember was probably in a paper I read from back in the 1990s. So it seemed useful just to review where our understanding was at and how long the list was, how many reinforcing feedback loops there are on there compared to the balancing feedback loops, and then think about, you know, how well are we modeling or representing these feedback loops in our efforts to model climate change. Because crucially, if we're missing some reinforcing loops, the reinforcing loops kind of amplify each other. So the more you have of them, the stronger the overall response.
Yes, that's one of the keys to this new paper. And you break things down into what I would call physical feedback mechanisms, and then biological mechanisms, and then human mechanisms. So it becomes quite a list. So I thought the role of biological life changing climate has been mainly left out by a lot of science, but not at all in this paper. You add 21 feedback mechanisms possible from the reactions of plants and animals to changing conditions. Are these biological feedbacks minor compared to the big physical systems like ocean currents or sea ice decline?
It depends is the kind of short answer, but some of them are quite significant. In fact, there's really important damping feedback that's coming, especially from the land biosphere and ecosystems. And we talk about that, at least scientifically, as what we call the land carbon sink. But it's the observation that of all of the greenhouse gas, mostly carbon dioxide, we humans put in the air each year, the land takes up more than a quarter, maybe sometimes a third of that. And that's a crucial damping feedback that's been slowing down, if you like, climate change. But there are equally a number of reinforcing feedbacks from the biosphere. And in fact, that one, the land carbon sink, there's a risk that different parts of the land surface can be tipped from a land carbon sink to a land carbon source due to the detrimental impacts of climate change on the biosphere, which could be things like droughts, impacting plant productivity and fires, destroying forests, and so on.
I was hoping to see more in the paper about the biological drivers, plankton and bacteria. You have one note about plankton and say it's uncertain, and microbiological activity is listed as positive, raising emissions of other greenhouse gases like nitrous oxide. But still, we don't know much about the world's largest mass of living matter, microscopic life, and we don't know how it will react to warming. Would you agree?
Well, we know something about it, but we need to know more. So characteristically, when you warm things up, microbes generally like that, and they do their metabolic processes, like maybe they respire carbon with oxygen, just like you and I do, or maybe they live in anoxic oxygen-free conditions, and maybe they turn organic carbon into methane. Both of those processes are pretty highly temperature sensitive. And so if you warm the world up, you get more carbon respired or turned into methane, both of which things are amplifying feedbacks on climate change. But what we don't know as well as we should is whether, if you warm the world up and give it a bit of time, will the microbial community change, and change in a way where those responses aren't the same, basically. Some experiments have shown, this is experiments where deliberate warming of soils, for example, is done. Some of those experiments have shown that if you give it enough time, in biologist language, the microbial community changes or acclimates to the changed climate, and maybe the rates of those carbon release processes come back down again, which would be good news if it was more widely true.
So your master list of feedbacks includes seven that are negative or damping, as you say, and these should cool the planet or at least slow down warming. Could those factors also amplify enough to compete with human-induced warming?
Not as far as any of our models would suggest. In fact, there's more of a worry that the damping feedbacks, especially in the carbon cycle, so what are called the land and ocean carbon sinks, if anything, are going to get sort of proportionally weaker than they have been due to the climate change. Then there are these physical damping feedbacks, but they're kind of governed by the laws of physics, certainly in the case of the one that we hardly ever think about, which is any warm body in the universe, if you make it warmer, it gives off more radiation, or if you cool it down, it gives off less radiation. Well, that's like a famous physical kind of law almost, but it's not about to change, and we know exactly how that relationship works. Where things are quite uncertain and important is in how do clouds respond to climate change. Some cloud feedbacks can damp climate change, others could amplify it. And it's just an area, a massive area of work to still try to get to the bottom of the different cloud feedbacks and how they might change in the changing climate. But recently there's been some progress on that using like satellite measurements to get a better handle on, for example, whether clouds over the Great Southern Ocean are full of ice crystals or not. And that turns out to really matter for the resulting climate feedback. Because when we warm the world up, if your clouds are full of ice crystals that melt into little water droplets, that's actually quite a good damping feedback. It turns out the clouds get more reflective if you turn the ice into water. But the measurements told us that, oh, actually those clouds have got a lot less ice in them than we thought they did. And that means when you warm the world up, you can quite rapidly max out or switch off that feedback and stop its damping effects. That turns out to be really important because, unfortunately, that means without that damping feedback, you suddenly get much more global warming for any given change in greenhouse gas levels.
In 2018, two of your co-authors published a classic paper, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. In that paper, Figure 2 showed a possible shelf called Stabilized Earth, much safer than warming all the way to hothouse Earth. And since then, humans have only increased greenhouse gas emissions even more this year, cresting at 3.5 parts per million added. Given the 27 positive feedback loops with many tipping points and nearby in time, do you think an alternative to hothouse Earth is still possible?
I do think so, thankfully. And I was an author on that 2018 paper. It's still possible. And there are probably other Earths that we weren't drawing on the diagram as well that are possible. I would call one of them the wet house Earth, where we've lost major ice sheets, the sea levels are much higher, and the continental coastlines are redrawn. But yeah, luckily we're still in a situation where there is overall quite a lot of amplifying feedback in the system, but not enough to send us over the metaphorical cliff edge into hothouse Earth. Basically, we're in a situation where with no feedbacks at all, except for the sort of fundamental laws of physics, if we doubled the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, we would have expected about 1.2 degrees centigrade of warming, whereas including the feedbacks we know about, we expect that number to be more like 3 degrees centigrade on the century timescale and could be as much as 6 degrees centigrade on the long millennial timescale. So that's saying that there is a lot of overall amplification in the climate system, but crucially it's not at the point where it will go into runaway and just be self-propelling warming, which is the hothouse Earth scenario. We still need to really work out how plausible and how much extra push it needs to get to hothouse Earth. But the crucial thing is, if you have a system that's already quite a strong amplifier and there's some feedback you missed that is just a little bit of extra amplification, well, it adds disproportionately onto what you already have. And people who do electrical engineering and make circuits and actual real amplifiers know this quite well. So that's the crucial stuff we're trying to get to the bottom of, and hopefully this paper helps a little bit.
In 2017, the IPCC said average global warming reached 1 degree C, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, over pre-industrial. They predicted 1.5 degrees C of warming by 2040. Now, to me, that seems out the window. What do you think?
Well, I think we are going to hit 1.5 degrees C warming. When we're going to hit it, well, we could have a year soon, certainly in the 2030s, where we hit it temporarily, and the average will be going through 1.5 degrees C sometime in the 2030s or 2040s. But there's still a lot to play for, because from my own studies of damaging climate tipping points, we know that several are at risk, but those risks go up disproportionately more for each 0.1 degree C of warming. And the same would be true for other kinds of climate damages and impacts. So every 0.1 of a degree C counts is a simple message, I guess, even though it looks sadly like they're definitely going to transgress that 1.5 degree C target. And unfortunately, current policies, such as they are still taking us into a world that's going to be at least 2.5 degrees C warmer in the second half of this century. And depending on these feedbacks, could be quite a bit warmer than that.
You know, in this whole important paper, I only found one sentence where I strongly disagree. You and your co-authors write, quote, "The accuracy of climate models is of vital importance since they guide climate mitigation efforts by informing policymakers about the expected effects of anthropogenic emissions," end quote. But really, policymakers are not mitigating anything about emissions. We're just expanding into the natural world. It's all increasing. Do you think academics are over-optimistic about the role of science in this whole policy thing?
Well, we do have a propensity to be over-optimistic, and we like to believe that we live in a world of evidence-based policymaking. But I spend a bit of time with some great policymakers, and even they acknowledge that there's quite a lot of policy-based evidence-making, as they call it. So, and we're not all naive about the situation. On the plus side, there are some bold policies that might be presented as due to other reasons. But here I'm thinking of things like the Inflation Reduction Act in the US that are actually quite bold moves to incentivize and accelerate the transition to renewable energy, electrified transport, and all the rest, which isn't the whole solution. But from my own analysis, it's clear we need strong policies to greatly accelerate our efforts to decarbonize the economy and to kind of switch from destroying forests and land use being a source of greenhouse gases to, you know, working with the land and ecosystems to hopefully to help them take up greenhouse gases. There's some policies that are really appearing now that are going to help that. We need more, but I'm not without some sense of realistic hope, I guess, whilst also realizing that often the science isn't really getting a full look in.
Tim Lenton, back to the science. What is the difference between feedback loops and tipping points, and do they interact?
So a tipping point is a particular kind of phenomenon that can happen when a reinforcing feedback loop within a system gets really strong. Gets so strong that if we think about it abstractly, if you put one unit of change into the system initially, it goes around the feedback loop once and gives you additional unit of change, which can then go around again and give you another unit and another unit. That's a kind of runaway situation. Most reinforcing feedback loops are not that strong. You put one unit of change in, you might get back 0.1 units of change. You go around again, you get 0.01 units of change, and so on, and that converges. So tipping points are like a special case of really strong reinforcing feedback, and that's how it's differentiated from this general picture of trying to understand both damping and reinforcing feedbacks of all kinds of strength. Also, this paper we're talking about is trying to look at the feedback on global temperature, basically. So feedback's explicitly at the global level. When I talk about a tipping point in a part of the climate system, the crucial strong reinforcing feedback that can bring about a tipping point is within that system, not necessarily to the whole global temperature. So what I mean is, like, within the Greenland ice sheet system, if you warm the Greenland ice sheet up, the surface drops in altitude, that puts into warmer air, which warms things up further, and that feedback can get strong enough to go into runaway. But it's not necessarily a strong feedback to the global temperature or the global situation. Those are the key distinctions, but clearly they're related. And some tipping points, like the possibility of abrupt thawing of the permafrost, which is kind of related to a feedback whereby there's heat gets released within the system that thaws more permafrost and so on. Well, that one is quite important for the other reason that it is also an important feedback to global warming. Not a runaway feedback to global warming, thankfully, but quite a significant amplifier. And that's super important, but not all. Some tipping points also have that amplifying feedback to global warming. Another one would be the tipping point for the Amazon rainforest would release a lot of carbon, as would a tipping point for boreal forests. Then there are other tipping points, like to lose coral reefs in the tropics on a large scale, that would be a disaster for lots of reasons, but would not have a strong feedback, not an amplifying one anyway, to global climate.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Professor Tim Linton from the University of Exeter, and we're talking about new science warning feedback loops could destabilize climate much sooner than we thought. Scientists Kevin Trenberth and Michael Mann suggest buffering by the global ocean is powerful enough to contain further warming, including feedback effects, once humans stop adding more greenhouse gases. Do you agree, or could a combination of feedbacks overpower even ocean buffering?
Well, what we know is that the ocean is doing a couple of important things. It's taking up carbon dioxide, so that's what we call the ocean carbon sink. And, yeah, it's taking up heat, and it's expanding because of that, and that's a key part of the global warming itself. And what our models suggest, interestingly, it varies from model to model, but if we could stop all the greenhouse gas emissions, the removal of carbon by the ocean, the sink, would gradually fall away, because the sink is driven basically by the emissions putting stuff into the atmosphere that then wants to react with the ocean. And as for the heat uptake of the ocean, well, most models would predict you would still have a time where you continue to take up heat in the ocean, because what the whole climate or planet is trying to do is find what we call energy balance. And we're in a situation where we're out of energy balance and there's more heat being trapped in the climate than can escape. And to balance things up, the ocean needs to warm up such that it will radiate more heat back out to space, basically. So that actually carries on for quite a while, even if you shut off the emissions. And there's a kind of competition between the fact that you'd expect the CO2 and greenhouse gas level in the atmosphere to be declining, but the ocean heat uptake might still be increasing. In some models, those two things kind of cancel out and you get a temperature flat line. In some models, you get a small cooling, that kind of like the declining greenhouse gases kind of wins. In other models, it carries on warming because still the ocean heat uptake and adjustment wins. Overall, best guess, which is sort of if you stop the emissions, you just get roughly a stable temperature for quite a long time. But it could go either way is the sort of the honest answer.
Some of the most radical projections out there on the net about warming, especially in the near term, build on the idea that we can add expected warming from each feedback mechanism to reach a scary total, like simple math. Other scientists caution it's not that simple. There's both positive warming and negative cooling feedbacks working around. What do you think?
Well, I'm with the it's not that simple, but what I would emphasize is our best assessment is we're in a situation of overall amplifying feedback, but it's constrained. It's not going to cause runaway, thankfully, runaway global climate change. But the big question is how much is the overall amplification? So that's why we build these sophisticated climate models and compare different models to see if we can get a consistent picture. And we still have quite a lot of uncertainty over what climate scientists call climate sensitivity, which is kind of a simple way of expressing how much is this overall amplification, because it just tries to describe how much warmer will the world get if you double the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere. And try as we might, for decades, we've been trying to narrow that thing down and get a best guess on it, and it still has a fair uncertainty range on it, and our best guess sometimes goes up and sometimes comes back down again. And what we've seen in the last decade is these new observations that I mentioned of those ice crystals and clouds over the southern ocean. Well, that, when it was used to inform the models, it suddenly tended to make the climate sensitivity higher in the models. So sometimes maybe we discover something new and improve the models and it goes the other way. But unfortunately, we're still living with that uncertainty. And we can constrain the lower limit on climate sensitivity with observations because, you know, we've seen a certain amount of warming. So the climate sensitivity can't be below the level that's needed to explain the warming we've seen. But it's harder to constrain the upper limit. And that's what we continue to work on.
So, Tim, do you and your colleagues think it's possible that warming, instead of climbing gradually, could jump up a step, arriving as surprising heat, not just as a series of events, but as a new state?
I sincerely hope that won't happen. I would just say that I'd like to be able to rule that out, but we can't rule it out. It's still what I'd call a possible scenario. Perhaps a scientist like me's task is to try to rule that out. And if they can't rule it out, then they have to keep highlighting it and encourage others to work on it. But in essence, for there to be that kind of global tipping point to a different climate state, the reinforcing feedbacks would need to be a little bit more and a little bit stronger than the models currently have them. And that's why this recent paper could be relevant, because it highlights a few reinforcing feedbacks and that may not be being modeled as much or as well as they should be. Equally, one could argue we might have missed some damping feedbacks that could bring things back the other way. So it's just in a risk assessment spirit that one has to say, well, if I can't rule out that really catastrophic outcome, I need to consider it and keep thinking about it and try to avoid it if it's possible.
From what I'm hearing from you, given our undeniable gains in climate knowledge, it sounds like we're still, as a civilization, rather stumbling around in the dark as we try to guess the amount and timing of climate disaster. Is that fair?
I sometimes feel like the blind man stumbling around looking for their keys, maybe, that they've dropped. I'd probably be honest, say it's not that bad. There's plenty of core aspects of the basics of climate change that are kind of 19th century physics and are well tied down. The problem, as you highlight, Alex, is definitely in these non-linear changes, tipping points, possibilities of strong feedback. That's where we need to keep working. And somewhat ironically, it feels like, as a whole, the climate community has not spent as much effort trying to tie those things down as it might have spent just trying to establish, you know, the most likely climate response. And I think there are lots of reasons historically why the focus was on trying to work out the most likely outcome, partly because we were in a very defensive mode as a community under continual attack from climate skeptics and deniers and vested interests and you name it. But now, hopefully, we've got past that. And now, if we want to give the rest of society a really good risk assessment, we need to look at the possibly less likely or more uncertain, but really high-impact outcomes and try to understand those and constrain those better.
And quickly, could you give us an example of one of the 15 human feedbacks that you found that could disrupt the climate?
I'm not even sure if this would have been one that we put in this particular paper, but it's one I remember from a study that inspired me that was published way back in the late 80s or early 1990s. Even then, Dan Lashoff, he spotted that, and this isn't good news, but he spotted that the warming of the Arctic was going to open up possible fossil fuel reserves in the Arctic that might then get exploited, which would add to the greenhouse gas emissions and add to the warming and the Arctic melting. That was quite a prescient forecast in 89 or 91 when he first published it, because unfortunately since then we have seen some global powers seeking to do just that.
So you're scientists, you're not officially activists, yet this new paper concludes we need transformative change to almost every aspect of human life, starting with the energy industry, but going on to population policies, education, and equality. It's a huge order. Why now? Why the urgency?
Well, because we feel like we're staring down the barrel of a climate gun. I think if you're someone like me and you see the evidence, well, partly the evidence that we could be at or very close to several big tipping points, but also evidence like the extraordinary climate extremes we've all witnessed on the television and some people have suffered directly in recent years. There can't be too many listeners not acknowledging that, wow, the climate is surprising us in a bad way with things we weren't expecting. So for me, I feel there's something constructive I can offer in the solution space, because the same tipping point thinking that we apply to the risks in the climate can also be applied to solving the climate crisis, because we know there are strong reinforcing feedbacks in the expansion of new technologies like renewable energy, electrified transport, and so on. And once we become aware of that, we can even begin to say, well, which policies and actions could make those reinforcing feedbacks stronger and could bring forward what I call positive tipping points to accelerate the change we need to reduce our impact on the planet.
From the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, we've been speaking with Professor Timothy Lenton. He is co-author of the new paper, Many Risky Feedback Loops Amplify the Need for Climate Action. It was published in the journal One Earth on February 17th, 2023. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim Lenton, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Okay, we are doomed. The atmosphere and now the weather's gone off the rails. The pandemic is supposedly over, but thousands of people still die every week. The stock market is shaky. Need I go on? If you know all that, what now? Longtime activist, prankster, and culture jammer Andrew Boyd has a few ideas. His latest book is out. It is called I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. From New York City, Andrew Boyd, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
This book, it isn't a book, really. It's kind of a journey, a pilgrim's progress, if you will. Do you really think it's time for the we are doomed conversation?
No. I think maybe the conversation is we could be doomed if we keep doing the destructive, irresponsible, unconscionable things that we are currently in the process of doing. It's a conversation of we could be doomed and what do we do to both not assume we are doomed and what can we do to not be doomed. So it's like both a question of a emotional, psychological, moral, spiritual orientation to decide that we must act in the face of our possible doom as well as what that would entail. And that's the book takes that up. It's not an easy question. It's not an obvious question. It's complicated. It requires a reckoning and digging down into our souls and sort of working out some strategies and, you know, making commitments and looking at some of the troubling, dark hole that we've dug for ourselves on the many fronts you mentioned, crossing ecological limits and their economic and social impacts in particular. What kind of hope is fit for purpose, given that we've already crossed some red lines that will permanently damage the planet and the life systems we depend on and tear at our social fabric in very unjust and unpleasant ways.
And you founded several movements that connected worried people and gave them some hope in each other. Tell us how the Climate Ribbon action works.
The Climate Ribbon is a global story sharing project, a way for us to move through our climate grief to climate action. Basically, it asks one central question and then a follow-up question. And that central question is, what do I love too much to lose? What's at stake for me? You know, where am I planting my flag here? What matters so much that I will take a stand and do what's necessary to protect it? You know, and we ask that question both in small gatherings in church rec rooms and in the streets of the hugest climate gatherings in New York, Paris, elsewhere. You know, the answers are quite diverse depending on, you know, who you are and what your experience is and what you dig down into and realize matters to you so much that you'll do something about it. One person said, the tree in my grandmother's backyard that I planted with her when I was 4 years old, you know, that was somebody from Macedonia. Other people said, you know, somebody from Southern Florida said, Miami, my city, you know, because that's the level of things that are kind of in the crosshairs that are at stake. An eight-year-old boy from the Rockaways in New York City, which was one of the areas worst hit by Hurricane Sandy, who'd seen all that he loved threatened and almost lost. You know, he said, my books, my toys, my apartment, my friends, my mom. He didn't want to lose that. He'd almost lost that once, and he didn't want to lose that again. And so then people sort of find the thing that matters to them, and then they write it on a ribbon, tie it onto an altar in a church or in a huge tree in some of these larger gatherings, and then alongside thousands of other ribbons of people writing similar things, and then find another one that matters to them, that moves them, and remove it from the big tree that it might be tied onto and tie it onto your wrist and become the sort of guardian of that person's thing that they most treasure. And someone's doing that with your ribbon. So we build a kind of what we called an intimate solidarity. You know, each person taking responsibility for the dearest thing that the other person doesn't want to lose, and sort of having that ground your commitment and make you feel like, you know, we're all in this together at some level, and I'm going to recommit to climate action and doing what I can to lessen the really negative outcomes from the unfolding climate catastrophe. And there's a follow-up question that we sometimes ask people to write on the back of the ribbon, which is, what do I love too much to lose on one side? And then what am I going to do about on the other side of the ribbon? We need to move through the grief, acknowledge, you know, what could be lost, give that its own due and space. Then, okay, what now? What do I do? What can I do? What's still worth doing? That's the climate ribbon.
You're also the chief existential officer, the CEO of something called Climate Clock. What is that?
That is also a global project that creates a timeline. The climate problem is not something that we can solve later. It's something we have to solve now. Bill McKibben says it is a timed test. As Greta says, if you're telling the climate story, but you're not including the notion of a ticking clock, you are not telling the true story. We have to accomplish certain things within a certain timeline, or else we are in even worse trouble than we already are. So it is very much a time bound, thus the emergency, referring to these the rest of this decade as the critical decade to take action. So if that's true, then there should be a clock that is keeping time, that is getting us on the right time frame, that is tracking our progress on the goals we need to meet within that time frame. So that's the climate clock. And it exists as a monument, first up in New York, but now in other cities around the world, in Glasgow and Seoul, Korea, and Rome, and other cities to come. And then also as a sort of handheld clock, as a tool for activists to hold decision makers accountable that has the numbers ticking on it. And the key numbers are, one, it has both a deadline and the progress we need to make. So it's both got a deadline and a lifeline, or a deadline and multiple lifelines. And the lifelines are solution pathways that we need to make progress on. And most notable of those solution pathways is the percentage of the world's energy currently coming from renewables. And that is up to 13.5%. That's a great accomplishment, and it is going in the right direction towards the 100% we need to get it up to, but it is not going fast enough. There's other things that we're tracking, you know, more justice-oriented solutions, including indigenous land sovereignty and et cetera. But let's just focus on the one key lifeline. So we need to get to 100% renewables within the shortest time period we possibly can. And that can happen by the rapid deployment of solar and wind. It can also happen by bending down our use of fossil fuels. So it can sort of happen in both a expansion of the new and an ending of the old. And we need much stronger measures to make the lifeline to 100% by the time the deadline goes to zero. And the clock currently reads six and a half years, basically. Yeah, and anyone can see all of that information, the science behind it, how to get involved, how to get your own clock and use it as a communication accountability tool in your own climate action work at climateclock.world, not .org or .com, but climateclock.world. All the information is there and how to get involved.
Hey, Andrew, weren't you the guy who famously prank bid $1.8 million on 22,000 acres of oil and gas drilling land in Utah just to stop the fossil fuel auction?
No, but that was someone I interviewed.
Ah, I would like to hear about that.
I have done many pranks in my time, but this one I didn't do, and this is one of the greatest climate action pranks ever, or let's just call it a creative direct action, if you will. So this is Tim DeChristopher, who's living in Utah. He's a well-regarded climate activist and was working with various grassroots groups in Utah trying to protect natural lands from various kinds of fossil fuel and other extraction. And during the very end of the Bush administration, there was an auction off of beautiful red rock lands in Utah for oil and gas leases. And he showed up at the auction. He wasn't sure why, you know, what his plan was, and, you know, kind of just tell people not to do this, tell people why this was destructive, make a statement. He wasn't sure. But before he could, you know, figure that out, someone said, "Are you here to bid?" And he kind of like had a momentary thought, you know, and he just, his sort of, you know, the gears started to click and he went, yes. And someone handed him a paddle. It said number 70. And then he became famously known later as Bidder 70. And he sort of walked into the auction and then he sort of like was looking around. A couple of things got auctioned off. And then he was like, wait, I'm going to bid. So he started bidding. And yeah, he didn't have any money, but he started bidding and he started winning all these lots, you know, like winning the leases to drill in this beautiful land that he wanted to protect, but he was winning these lots. And then eventually, you know, the auctioneer in charge of it realized there was something amiss because he wasn't recognized and he was bidding all these lots and people were looking strangely. We don't know who this is. So they shut, you know, the auctioneer sort of stopped the auction. And then he was brought up on charges and made a phenomenal speech at his hearing about the history of civil disobedience in the United States and how it's won all of these social and environmental victories, and was put in jail for 2 years, and then came out and decided, you know, thing after that. But basically, he went to divinity school at Harvard so that he could meld a faith-based approach to his climate disobedience work. And then I got the chance to interview him. Oh, and then in the end, what happened was because the auction was stopped and it was all got caught up in this sort of bureaucracy and legal sort of gray area. And by the time they sort of sorted it out, Bush had transitioned to Obama and Obama canceled that auction. It was all sort of under federal lands. And so none of those lands got auctioned off for extraction and they were preserved and defended. So this one individual taking an almost slight, you know, he knew he wanted to stop something that was bad, but he wasn't sure how, and sort of by his own wits and bravery and moxie managed to protect a whole swath of extraordinarily beautiful, pristine, beloved Red Rock country in Utah. So it just became an inspiration for people all across the country. If Tim could do this, what can I do?
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Welcome back. Alex is talking with author and activist Andrew Boyd. His latest book is I Want a Better Catastrophe.
Yeah, your book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, it's a pretty serious work. You went out and interviewed 7 leading post-doom thinkers from sort of the doomiest dark places to those with a bit more hope. Some of them have been guests on Radio EcoShock, but other ones I would never have encountered without you. So I think this is one of the real benefits of the book. It's like an introduction service.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, it was an extraordinary experience. As you said, it was a pilgrim's progress, a sort of journey. They're partly chosen for a diversity of voices and also people, you know, who are not pretending that things are better than they are and yet finding an ethical way to stay engaged, depending on the definition, even hopeful way to stay engaged. So that was sort of how I sought them out. You know, mentioned Tim DeChristopher alongside him, Joanna Macy, an eco-philosopher, beloved by many, Adrian Marie Brown, sort of a quote-unquote organizational healer and visionary fiction pioneer, Robin Wall Kimmerer, indigenous botanist and you know, a Gopal Dayanani, for example, a leading voice in the environmental justice and climate justice movements. And we had these wide-ranging interviews, and that's all captured and poured into the book. And a few takeaways, like Tim, for example, one of the things I was curious about is, how do people stay sane? How do they stay grounded? You know, how do they find an ethical framework to step forward into this scary, uncertain future? You know, we're all grappling, you know, with these our own versions of this question. Tim, for example, action for him was sort of a coping mechanism, was the thing that kept him able to sort of stare clear-eyed at our sort of unfolding, or as one person said, you know, our dark and darkening future. You know, so it was through action that kept him grounded. And he likened it metaphorically to a bicycle, of riding a bicycle. You know, yes, it's wobbly as you're learning to ride it, or it's wobbly as you first get on it. But once you start pedaling, you find your balance. That really struck me and stayed with me, that notion. Gopal Dayanani said, for example, like acknowledged, you know, we're in for a lot of suffering. So let's distribute that suffering equitably, not pretending things are better, but okay. But then what is our response? If we bring justice, if we can focus on justice, make a lot of the decisions about how we handle the crisis as it unfolds through a lens of justice, we might have bad outcomes, but we will have the best of the bad outcomes that are left to us. Adrienne Marie Brown, for example, said something very beautiful that stuck with me. And it was, you know, it's like, yes, we're in for a fall. So let's fall as if we were holding a child on our chest and sort of fall into it, you know, protecting that child, you know, whether that's the people we love, the places we love, you know, the next generation. You know, it's just sort of such a beautiful image of care and compassion and solidarity, and acknowledging that, yes, we're in for a big fall, but that doesn't mean we give up hope. That doesn't mean we fall into despair or doom. No, we have to act with all of our values, knowing that we're in for a tough decades or century starting now. This is some of the wisdom that sort of came to me and that I poured into the book and, you know, was changed by.
Andrew, would you give us a reading?
Yeah, I'll read. It's just one page long, and it is the title track of the book. It's I Want a Better Catastrophe is the title. Climate catastrophe is coming. We know this. What we don't know is how bad it will be. In the best case scenario, an unprecedented global Green New Deal rapidly transitions world economy off of carbon, holding global temperature rise under 3 degrees centigrade. This, unfortunately, causes large-scale polar ice melt, 12 inches of sea level rise by 2050, and major habitat disruption. We lose Miami, Shanghai, and many of our greatest cities. Tens of thousands of species become extinct. Coastal flooding and systemic crop failure lead to hundreds of millions of climate refugees, global resource wars, and partial social breakdown. But enough of us survive, and a chastened version of civilization, one that's learned to live within sustainable limits, stumbles through. That's our best case scenario. In the worst case scenario, runaway global warming of 6 degrees centigrade plus superheats the planet, wiping out humanity and many complex life forms. In the worst case scenario, catastrophe is total. But in the best case scenario, what we do matters. If projections tell us that 1 million of the Earth's species are on track to die off, and we can do something to help make that only 50,000, 500,000, shouldn't we try? We must protect all that we can. We must do everything possible to limit the damage, including gracefully powering down our civilization and becoming lean and resilient enough to survive in a broken ecosphere with our humanity intact. What we want here is a better catastrophe. Imagine the protest rallies. Alex, imagine. What do we want? A better catastrophe. When do we want it? As late in the century as possible. Door-to-door recruitment? Excuse me, ma'am. Care to sign this petition to only half fuck over the planet? A little bit of a joke there, but, you know, captures a little bit of the task of someone trying to tell the truth and do something about it. A defeatist attitude, you say? Hardly. It's hard-nosed, courageous, and full of hope for the future. What was Winston Churchill's rallying cry in the darkest moments of World War II? Quote, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Not exactly an upbeat message. He wasn't one to overpromise, and nor should we. He too had a choice of catastrophes. Europe as a Nazi-occupied death camp, or Europe bombed to pieces and split down the middle with some takeaway wisdom about the nature of evil. He chose a better catastrophe, and so should we. If catastrophe is where we're headed, let's fight hard to get the best catastrophe we can.
Wow. And I also want to talk about, well, a few parts of your new book. They came out in Dark Mountain in 2017 as you were working on it. For example, who are the 12 characters of the apocalypse and how did they end up touring England and Wales?
This was a many years process writing this book, and it began as one thing and ended as another, and there were many different stages of it in between. One of those stages was trying to capture many different perspectives in these tiny little sort of day in the inner life vignettes of how people are experiencing and responding to what I call the impossible news that the climate scientists are bringing to us. So, you know, an eco-anarchist in plotting in the basement, do eco-sabotage to try to stop the industrial machinery in their city from doing more damage. You know, another was someone who's just decided, I think it was called Let's Party Because It's 2099. You know, someone who just decided there's no hope, we're doomed, so why not just throw caution to the winds and burn as much carbon as they wanted and travel around the world and, you know, stay up all night, you know, in clubs and, you know, lean into the end of times hedonism. You know, there's logic to all of these POVs, you know, these different responses. Other was sort of concerned community member who decides we're not going to really try to do things at the national or global level. Let's just fall back to the community level and get our own house in order. They're kind of following along the transition towns prescription, you know, building as just as possible resilient communities to cause the least amount of damage locally and also be, you know, prepare our towns and communities for for the impacts as they sort of unfold. So each had very different, you know, perspectives, and I tried to honor each. There was no like critique. Even there was even a prepper, you know, who's sort of building their bunker and booby trapping it and the whole deal, and just trying to get inside the head of each person and all of these different responses that are sort of happening out there in society, and, you know, but sort of grounded in the inner voice of a particular individual who sort of might be going through that and their sort of reasons and logic and what it feels like to them. And I bundled them together and published this piece on the Dark Mountains blog, and it was called 12 Characters in Search of an Apocalypse, you know, as a sort of play on Pirandello, the title of Pirandello's famous play. A few of those ended up in the book, but they not in this sort of cast of characters so much.
I want to move on to the whole question of hope. There is hope, or at least there used to be, and you spent a whole chapter, complete with a wall-sized flowchart, to find the remains of hope and sort of justify it. And I'm wondering, why all that angst? Can't we go on to meaningful lives without hope?
Well, in my cultural scouting, in my investigations and talking to people, hope kept coming up, and people had extremely different attitudes about hope. Some could not imagine going on without it. Others sort of dismissed it as, you know, unnecessary. Let's just, you know, our house is on fire. Let's just do something about it, hope or no hope. So there are very different sort of attitudes about it, but it kept coming up again and again. So, arguably this whole book is an investigation into hope and what kind of hope serves us. And I can share a passage from the book that addresses that, if you'd like.
I would.
There's a whole chapter in the book with multiple pieces in it called Is There Hope? So in the face of looming catastrophe, we don't know whether to double down on hope or give up hope completely. You know, we're not hopeful because things like the facts are pretty hopeless, but we're not hopeless either because, you know, we love life. We have a heart that still beats, and some part of us will always remain an irrepressible hope machine. It's a paradox, a human paradox, but that's how we do. And so we need a strategy. We need a way to walk our paradoxical path, a way to twin our warring selves. What kind of hope can still serve us? You know, there are many, many kinds. Four that I outline in the book are passive hope, heroic hope, stoic hope, and grounded hope. And I'll just step listeners through those four very, you know, briefly here. Passive hope is super positive. You know, it's almost Pollyanna-ish. It naively trusts that either technology will fix things or since the Earth's climate has changed before, we'll be fine. You know, the basic attitude is like, don't worry, be happy. You know, somehow it's all going to work out. This might give you some peace of mind, but it leaves little reason to act. And we actually really, really do need to act. Okay, so heroic hope is also hyper-optimistic, but it's far more action-oriented. You know, it lives by the credo, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. It takes a yes, we can. There's no limit to human ingenuity. Just do it kind of attitude. You know, despite their striking differences, you know, between passive hope and heroic hope, you know, they share one important quality. They both depend on results, good results. And when actual outcomes turn sour and dark, you know, or threaten to, you know, as I would argue we're in store for, you know, it's kind of hardwired into our near and far future. You know, this kind of optimism-based hope, this results-based hope can quickly crumble and turn into pessimism. All right. So now what? Aha. So fortunately, we have two other kinds of hope to turn to, stoic hope and grounded hope. Stoic hope says we can handle it. We've survived tough times before. Whatever happens, we can make it through. We can rebuild. You know, and if the worst comes to really worse, I'll drown with my boots on. But you know, this kind of stoic hope, it's sturdy, it's resilient, but it's not particularly proactive or strategic. Doesn't think down the field and take action. It just sort of hangs in there and kind of holds on and tries to get through. But we need to be both proactive and strategic. Enter grounded hope. This kind of hope, grounded hope, embraces the full paradox of our predicament. It says, yes, it's hopeless, and I'll give it my all anyway. This kind of hope is not dependent on outcomes, nor attached to optimism or pessimism. Instead, it's grounded in our character and our calling. It recognizes the full difficulty of our situation, yet still chooses to be hopeful. Grounded hope channels the pivotal insight of Václav Havel, the playwright and ex-president of the Czech Republic. Hope, he says, is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. You know, grounded hope offers us no guarantee that we'll ever walk out of the darkness, but it shows us how to walk through it. Basically, you're doing what's right and what is necessary, and the doing and the walking are their own reward. And it comes back a bit to Tim DeChristopher, the way he explained hope to me. His notion of hope is very different than what you would normally expect, and it was very sort of striking to me. And, you know, his understanding of hope is that it is the will to hold on to our values in the face of difficulty. So I'll leave you with that. That's a lot of what the book is about, is sort of finding the kind of hope that can serve us when we should not be relying on good outcomes, because we've really crossed certain red lines that are going to make our future very, very challenging. So what kind of hope can help us sort of navigate our way forward? A grounded kind of hope. And there's many wisdom teachers have landed there, and the book is full of a lot of guidance from a lot of different quarters for how to, for each of us can find our own way to a grounded hope in this dark time.
Andrew Boyd's new book is I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. Find it wherever books are sold, and I'll include a few more teaser quotes in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for spending so much time with us here at the end of the world.
You are so welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
In view of the gravity of the situation, believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times.
Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week. And thank you for caring about this world.
We are going to hit 1.5 degrees C warming. When we're going to hit it, well, we could have a year soon, certainly in the 2030s, where we hit it temporarily, and the average will be going through 1.5 degrees C sometime in the 2030s or 2040s. But there's still a lot to play for, because from my own studies of damaging climate tipping points, we know that several are at risk, but those risks go up disproportionately more for each 0.1 degrees C of warming. And the same would be true for other kinds of climate damages and impacts. So every 0.1 of a degree C counts is a simple message, I guess, even though it looks sadly like they're definitely going to transgress that 1.5 degree C target. And unfortunately, current policies, such as they are still taking us into a world that's going to be at least 2.5 degrees C warmer in the second half of this century. and depending on these feedbacks, could be quite a bit warmer than that.
James Baldwin.
I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive.
As long as I'm in this sinking ship and I have a can, I'm going to start bailing and keep working in that direction.
We had an understanding, we thought, of when climate change would begin to arrive. And we got that from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a group of scientists who have to report to governments, I might add, on what they say. And it looked like people were talking about 2040, 2050, we'd see the first really big hits. But the scientists that I talk to now have brought that way forward and say, no, it's happening now.
Yes.
We're getting it right now. We're seeing some sea level rise now. We're seeing storm surges like in Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. We're seeing the Arctic melt, which just blew everyone's mind, frankly. No one had expected that to happen.
Log Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio Free Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
That's right. Well, welcome back. Coming up, I want to tell you something. TUC Radio, Maria Gillardin, or Mariah Gillardin, produces it, and it's on over 60 radio stations, none here in Kansas. And it also goes to a lot of rural communities. She built this thing from the ground up, starting in San Francisco, well over 20 years ago. And if you've ever went to her site, and I encourage you to do that, at tucradio.org. If you go to it, you'll find out an incredible catalog of programs that are free that you can download. Now, of course, you know, as I say all the time here on Radio Free Kansas, you should support those who support Radio Free Kansas. So, I mean, it's an act of solidarity, you know. I don't hit you up for money. I really don't. And instead, I encourage you to support those who volunteer their programming for your ears through my Blog Talk Radio channel. She, Ms. Gillardin, built her and her friends built a off-the-grid house. I think it's somewhere north of San Francisco, and she moved there a number of years ago, and she's been up there producing these shows since then, and I really find it amazing that she can do this off the grid with the help of her friends, and that she still produces the shows. One of the side highlights, I know many of you who listen to RFK have read or heard of Michael Parenti. I would strongly encourage you to go to tucradio.org and check out the catalog. It's some of the many rare speeches are kept there that Michael Parente delivered over the years. The whole part of her catalog of Parente's work, talking about his books and the thing, and his experiences. It's very eye-opening that she's kept this. It's rare, very hard to find, Michael Parente's audio lectures. But once again, support those who support Radio Free Kansas. Thank you. Now on to TUC, Time for Useful Conscience.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness, Feminist Theology and Women in the Muslim World. Dr. Rifat Hassan is a Muslim theologian from Pakistan. She says that since anti-woman legislation and custom are enacted in the name of theology, it is necessary to study the Quran and critique the source. This required courage, since challenging traditional interpretation of the Quran can be a capital offense. On the other hand, we are all familiar with the claim that Islam has given women more rights than any other religious tradition, and Rifat Hassan decided to deal with that contradiction. Rifat Hassan began her quest in 1984 when her feminist friends in Pakistan asked her to help define the theological argument for women's liberation. That request changed her life. The events of 9/11 made her work much harder, but she continued to search for legislation inside Pakistan to help women, and she tried in many ways to promote understanding of Islam internationally. You are about to hear a rare TUC Radio Archive recording that I made of Rifat Hassan in April 1993 at UC Berkeley. I had never heard a purely theological argument for women's liberation and learned much about Islam that night. What touched me was the recognition how closely related Islam, Christianity, and Judaism are, making women of these three faiths the largest minority of any kind in the world. The basic myth of Adam and Eve is embedded in all three religions and is used by all of them to define woman as secondary, inferior, and sinful. In this talk, Rifat Hassan takes a closer look at the original story told in the Quran, and by the end of this program, your idea of Adam's identity, or who was first, and the whole issue of the rib will become thoroughly shaken. Get ready for some door slamming as some unhappy men in the audience left the auditorium. But first, get to know the person, Dr. Rifat Hassan.
Before I begin, I would like to greet all of you with the Islamic greetings, Assalamu Alaikum, and to share with you, first of all, something of my own background and how I came to work in the area of women in the Islamic tradition. I have always known what it is to be a Muslim woman since I was born in a Sayyid Muslim family living in Lahore, a historic Muslim city in Pakistan, a country created in the name of Islam. But it was not until 1974 when I was teaching at Oklahoma State University in a place called Stillwater, which lives up to its name, that I started almost accidentally and rather reluctantly on my career as a theologian. Each year they would hold a seminar, and it was a custom that the faculty advisor would make a presentation. Now, generally speaking, the faculty advisor could speak on anything that he wanted to speak on, but in my case, I was assigned a specific subject. I was told to speak about women in Islam. Now, I felt a little bit affronted by this imposition of topic. It was apparent to me that I had been given this subject because the people who belonged to this chapter, who were mostly Arab Muslims, felt that I wasn't competent to speak about anything else, even though I taught them Islamic studies. and so they assigned to me the subject. However, I accepted this invitation for two reasons. One was that for the first time, this group had been put in a position where they had to have a woman speaker. This group would not allow women even in its audience. And so I felt that that in itself was a breakthrough. And the second reason was that I was so tired of reading book after book, article after article, brochure after brochure about women in Islam, all of them written by Muslim men. You have no idea how many there are. Now, my secret dream, of course, is to one day write something about the role and position and status of Muslim men or man in Islam, because I'm becoming very concerned about the fact that nothing is written on this subject, and I sort of feel that there is no role or status or position of man in Islam. It's only women who have that honor. So I'd sort of like to do something in that regard. But anyhow, until I get there, I thought that it was important to study this question from a woman's perspective. I had studied the Quran, and I used the Quran as a textbook, in fact, in my courses on Islam. But I had not done a focused study of the Quranic passages dealing with women. I started to do that, to look deeper into these passages, particularly those passages which are controversial, more difficult passages. I do not know exactly at what time my academic study of women in Islam became a passionate quest for truth and justice on behalf of Muslim women. It happened when I realized the impact on my own life of the so-called Islamic ideas and attitudes regarding women. And I began to realize that so many things had happened to me in my own life because I had been born female in a Muslim society. So what began as a scholarly exercise became simultaneously an Odyssean venture in self-understanding. But enlightenment does not always bring endless bliss. And the more I saw the justice and compassion of God reflected in the Quran, the more anguished and angry I became, seeing the injustice and inhumanity to which Muslim women in general are subjected in actual life. I began to feel strongly that it was my duty, as part of the microscopic minority of educated Muslim women, to do as much consciousness raising regarding the situation of Muslim women as I could. So this journey, which began in Stillwater, has been an arduous one and has taken me far and wide in pursuit of my quest. When I think of the situation of my sisters, who despite being the largest minority in the world, more than half of the 1 billion strong Muslim Ummah, remain for the most part nameless, faceless, and voiceless, I know that there is no end to this journey in sight. Despite the fact that women such as Khadija and Aisha, wives of the Prophet Muhammad, and Rabia al-Basri, the outstanding Muslim Sufi saint, figure significantly in early Islam, the Islamic tradition has, by and large, remained rigidly patriarchal until the present time. Prohibiting the growth of scholarship among women, particularly in the realm of religious thought. This means that the sources on which the Islamic tradition is mainly based, namely the Quran, the Sunnah, the Hadith literature, and fiqh, have been interpreted only by Muslim men who have arrogated to themselves the task of defining the ontological, theological, sociological, and eschatological status of Muslim women. It is hardly surprising that until now the majority of Muslim women have accepted the situation passively, almost unaware of the extent to which their human, also their Islamic, in an ideal sense, rights have been violated by their male-dominated societies, which have continued to assert, glibly and tirelessly, that Islam has given women more rights than any other religious tradition. In recent times, largely due to the pressure of anti-women laws that are being promulgated under the cover of what is known as Islamization in some parts of the Muslim world, women with some degree of education and awareness are beginning to realize that religion is being used as an instrument of oppression rather than as a means of liberation. To understand the strong impetus to Islamize Muslim societies, especially with regard to women-related norms and values, it is necessary to know that of all the challenges confronting the Muslim world today, perhaps the greatest is that of modernity. Women, both educated and uneducated, who are participating in the national workforce and contributing toward national development, think and behave differently from women who have no sense of their individual identity or autonomy as active agents in history. Not too long ago, many women in Pakistan and also in other Islamic countries were jolted out of their dogmatic slumber by the enactment of laws as well as by threatened legislation, which was aimed to reduce them systematically, virtually mathematically, to less than men. In the face of both military dictatorship and religious autocracy, valiant efforts have been made by women's groups in Pakistan to protest against the instituting of manifestly anti-women laws and to highlight cases of gross injustice and brutality toward women. However, it is still not clearly and fully understood, even by many women activists in Pakistan as well as in other Muslim countries, that the negative ideas and attitudes pertaining to women that prevail in Muslim societies are in general rooted in theology, and that unless or until the theological foundations of the misogynistic and androcentric tendency in the Islamic tradition are demolished, Muslim women will continue to be brutalized and discriminated against despite improvement in statistics such as those on female education, employment, and social and political rights. In my judgment, the importance of developing what the West calls theology or feminist theology in the context of Islam is paramount today, with a view to liberating not only Muslim women but also Muslim men from unjust structures and laws that make a peer relationship between men and women impossible. It is good to know that in the last 100 years, there have been at least 2 significant Muslim men scholars and activists, Qasim Amin from Egypt and Mumtaz Ali from India, who have been strong advocates of women's rights. I remember how stricken I felt when I first began to see the glaring discrepancy between Islamic ideals and Muslim practice insofar as women are concerned. I set out to articulate what I considered to be the normative Islamic view of women. And in 1979, I wrote a monograph, which has never been published, called Women in the Quran, in which I gave a detailed exposition of those passages of the Quran which relate to women in various contexts. For example, women vis-a-vis God, women in the context of human creation in the story of the fall, women as daughters, wives, and mothers, women in the context of marriage, divorce, inheritance, segregation, veiling, witnessing to contract, economic rights, afterlife, etc. In particular, I focused attention upon those passages which were regarded as definitive in the context of man-woman relationship and upon which the alleged superiority of men to women rested. In 1983 and 84, I spent 2 years in Pakistan. Now, this happened to be a period of time when Islamization in Pakistan was at its peak, and a lot of laws, anti-women laws, were being enacted. And in the wake of these laws, a lot of brutality was being exhibited toward Muslim women. As a result of these oppressive laws, the feminist movement, or the women's movement, or the women's activist movement, was born in Pakistan. These women, for the most part, were Western-educated women, because those women were the only women who had the ability to lead any kind of a political movement in the country. And many of them were women with great character and courage, and they were able to take great personal risk in the face of martial law, which was prevailing in the country. But despite the fact that they were not lacking in courage or commitment, they felt that they were not succeeding in their struggle. And the reason why they were not succeeding in their struggle was because the laws that were being enacted in the country were being enacted in the name of God, in the name of religion, in the name of Islam. And a religious argument cannot be overturned by political action. A religious argument can only be overturned by a better religious argument. And so some of these women who happened to be my friends or who knew me asked me if I would help them. That was for me a historic moment of my life. Because for 10 years, from 1974 to 1984, I had been doing this work essentially and primarily for myself. I was trying to make some sense out of my own life. But at this point, when I was asked by the women's groups in Pakistan to provide them with a theology and an ideology on which they could base their movement, this became for me a radically different situation, and I had to rethink virtually everything that I had done. I spent that summer thinking very hard about this issue and in reading two kinds of materials or two bodies of material. I did a systematic study of the two major hadith collections in Sunni Islam, namely Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Those two books are next in authority only to the Quran as far as the Sunni Muslims are concerned. And I also spent time studying the work of some contemporary Jewish and Christian women and men, feminist theologians. And at the end of my period of study and reflection, I came to see that there are three assumptions which lie at the root of the attitudes, negative attitudes toward women, not only in the Islamic tradition, but also in the Jewish and Christian traditions. And these three assumptions are the following. First, that God's primary creation is man, not woman, since woman is believed to have been created from man's rib, hence is derivative and secondary ontologically. Second, that woman, not man, was the primary agent of what is described as the fall of man, or man's expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Hence, all daughters of Eve are to be regarded with hatred, suspicion, and contempt. And number three, that woman was created not only from man, but also for man, which makes her existence merely instrumental and not of fundamental importance. To me, the most important of these three questions is the first question, is the question of creation. The ordinary Muslim believes, as seriously as the ordinary Jew or Christian, that Adam was God's primary creation and Eve was made from Adam's rib. This belief is very strange, given the fact that there is no mention of the rib story in the Quran. Now let me give a little bit of background of this rib story. There are in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, which is the opening book of the Bible, there are two creation stories. There's one creation story, which is given in chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. This is attributed to a writer called the priestly writer who lived in the 5th century BCE. And the second story, which is given in chapter 2 of Genesis, verses 18 to 24, is attributed to a writer called the Yahvist writer who lived in the 10th century BCE, which is 500 years before the other writer. Now, the first creation story, or the one that's in chapter 1 of Genesis, is egalitarian, and it talks about God creating Ha'adam, which means the human in the image of God, creating it male and female and giving them dominion over the sea and the earth and so on. Whereas the second story, which is in the second chapter of Genesis, is a story that everybody knows about God creating Adam. Adam was lonely, and so God put Adam to sleep, and out of the rib of Adam, God created Eve. And the way that this story has been interpreted through the centuries has been very detrimental to women because, as I indicated before, it has led to the inference that God's primary creation was Adam, Adam in Hebrew, which is interpreted as being a male person, and so the male person becomes primary and the woman is derived from this male person and is secondary. Now, as the work of many feminist theologians indicates, the interpretation, the traditional interpretation of the story in what is generally referred to as the Judeo-Christian tradition, but mainly it is the Christian tradition, is erroneous because Adam in Hebrew does not mean a male person. The word Adam in Hebrew means the human. And so it's a generic word, it's a collective noun, and it refers to humanity as a whole. If one were to read the Bible in the Hebrew, which is the language of the Bible, the original language of the of what we call the Old Testament, then this would be self-evident. But to most people, most Jews, Christians, and Muslims, Adam is the name of a male person. Now, as far as the Quranic account of creation is concerned, there are two or three very interesting things that we need to note. First of all, we note that there are the word Adam is found 25 times in the Quran. The word Adam is not an Arabic word. It's a Hebrew word which has been co-opted into the Arabic language. Now, Arabic and Hebrew are, of course, sister languages. They are both Semitic languages. But since the word is originally Hebrew, it means the same thing in Arabic as it means in the Hebrew language, and it means, therefore, the human. It's very important and interesting to note that in the Quran there is no Eve. There is no Eve in the Quran. There is an Eve in the Islamic tradition called Hawa. Again, that's a Hebrew word, but there is no Eve in the Quran. And why should there be any Eve in the Quran if Adam represents humanity, which is what the word means? Now, there are 30 passages in the Quran which deal with the subject of human creation. Now, of course, the Quran is not structured like the Bible, and it's not chronological, and therefore you do not find all accounts of human creation in chapter 1 of the Quran. They are scattered throughout the Quran. But if you collect all these passages and you study them, you see that there are three generic terms that are used in these contexts. And these three generic terms are An-Nas, Al-Insan, and Bashr. And all three of these terms represent or refer to humanity as a whole. They do not refer to either male or female exclusively. As pointed out by Muhammad Iqbal, the outstanding Muslim poet philosopher of the 20th century, quote, indeed in the verses which deal with the origin of man as a living being, the Quran uses the word Bashr or Insan, not Adam, which it reserves for man in his capacity of God's vicegerent on earth. The purpose of the Quran is further secured by the omission of proper names mentioned in the biblical narration, Adam and Eve. The word Adam is retained and used more as a concept than as the name of a concrete human individual. This use of the word is not without authority in the Quran itself. Now here we come to a very interesting situation, and that is that though there is no rib story in the Quran, and these 30 accounts of human creation that I have referred to, if you look at them, there is no mention in any of these passages of the creation of a male person prior to that of a female person. There's no such reference, no such implication possible if you study these passages accurately. However, if you ask an average Muslim any place in the world, and I've done this pop quiz in many places in the world, you ask a Muslim, how was Eve created? And the answer comes back without a batting of an eyelid, from the rib of Adam. I said, so you've been reading Genesis. The story is certainly not in the Quran. It's not a Quranic story. Not only is it not a Quranic story, but it is antithetical. It is against the teaching of the Quran on the subject of human creation. There is an expression in the Quran which is found in several passages, which is interpreted in a very interesting way. Chapter 4, which is Surah An-Nisa, chapter on women in the Quran, verse 1, it talks about the creation of humanity. God created humanity. And it goes on to say, خَلَقَكُمْ مِنْ نَفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ. And God created all of you, in the plural, all of humanity, مِنْ نَفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ, from one single nafs. Now, nafs is a word that's translated variously as self, as being, as entity, as person. There's a big discussion on it. So anyhow, for the time being, let's say it means being or entity. The other important thing is that in Arabic, every word is either masculine or feminine, and nafs happens to be feminine, grammatically. And so it says, and God created all of you from one single nafs, nafs being grammatically feminine. And then it goes on to say, وَخَلَقَ Minha, Zaujha. And God created Minha, means from her, her going back to Nafs, which is feminine, Zaujha, her mate. Now, what's very interesting, that's interesting, but what's more interesting, the reason I'm citing this, is because, for example, Yusuf Ali, whose Quran I have here, which is one of the most popular translations of the Quran, says here, O mankind, reverence your guardian Lord who created you from a single person, created of like nature his mate, and from them twins scattered like seeds countless men and women. Now, there is no question at all that Ha means her and not his. There is not a single translation of the Quran in any language which says that. I believe I have looked at over 100 translations in English alone, and I haven't found one that says that. Most of them, I think over 95 or 96% say his. A couple, two or three maybe, that I have seen say it, its mate, which is better in some ways, but there is no it in the Arabic language. Now the question, this is a serious question from one point of view, because Muslims take the Quran very seriously. So why is it and how is it that these eminent scholars of Islam who undertake to translate the Quran presumed to correct the grammar of the Quran? Because how has this her become his? So this is just to give you a little flavor of how language, how the politics of language works and how important it is that by changing one single word, you turn the whole thing around.
That was Dr. Rifat Hassan, a Muslim theologian from Pakistan, recorded at UC Berkeley in April 1993. Come back when TUC Radio returns to see how the original story in the Quran was altered by later writers and translators. When feminist theologian Rifat Hassan said anti-woman writing was added later by companions of the Prophet, doors were slammed.
The Quran, on the basis of my years of study, guarantees human freedom and equality. Up till this point, it has not been possible to raise any critical question about the companions of the Prophet. It's a capital crime.
And those who walked out and slammed the door were young men, students at UC Berkeley in 1993. Now, 30 years later, women are losing power, even in democracies. Women held as secondary, sinful, and in need of control by men based on their religion are the biggest minority on earth. Just Islam and Christianity control over 55% of world population. That may be an opportunity, along with the growing interest in pronouns. Rifat Hassan was professor of religious studies and humanities at the University of Louisville, Kentucky. She received her PhD from Durham University, UK in 1968 and has taught in many institutions, including Oklahoma State University and Harvard Divinity School. She retired in 2009 after 33 years of teaching. This was a rare TUC Radio Archive recording brought back for International Women's Month. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.